So I'll start with the traditional idea of a simple life, which is that the wandering mendicants were living a simple life in order to be free from distractions, to have the time and space to meditate and reflect and so on. And what that meant quite specifically was being free from family responsibilities, free from having to earn a livelihood, and being free to meditate and reflect, free to learn the Dharma. I was going to say study, but I didn't have texts, so free to learn the Dharma, free to teach the Dharma. And also part of it was that they were not to be a burden on society. There's that verse in the Dhammapada which talks about, let the silent sage move about in the village as the bee goes, taking honey from the flower, without harming color or fragrance. So not being a burden on the society around them was also part of the reason for living a simple life. And of course, a simple life for the Buddha and his followers was an extremely simple life, where they did no work and didn't live in any kind of shelter. They just wandered. For Sri Ratna, for us, the simple life is about the conditions that allow us to live a spiritual life, conditions that make a difference as well. And what I've read is that it was initially retreat experiences that led people to want to live in communities. People went on retreat, experienced better conditions for a week or two, had a really good experience, both in terms of their own meditation practice and so on, but also in terms of friendship and being with other Buddhists. And they wanted to prolong that experience outside of the retreat situation, wanted to prolong those conditions. And that led to the establishing of communities. And the experience of single-sex retreats led to the establishing of single-sex communities. In addition to that, wanting to prolong those conditions in order to have a more kind of intense experience of spiritual life and to have good conditions for living spiritual life, the desire to share the Dharma led to the establishment of Buddhist centers. And the need for funds, the need for money to create those Buddhist centers led to the establishment of team-based right livelihoods. So some of the very first team-based right livelihoods were established around the London Buddhist Center in the mid-1970s. Ratnaguna established Friends Foods by setting up a market stall to sell health foods. Some others established a building team. There was a hardware shop. There were various other things that were established back then. There was print and design, and so on. So there was the desire to practice more fully and more intensively, which led to the establishment of the communities, the desire to spread the Dharma, leading to the establishment of centers, and the need for money, leading to the establishment of right livelihood businesses. And so the desire to intensify practice overall led to seeing the simple life as a desirable set of conditions. And the simple life meant not needing to earn lots of money, and therefore not needing to put a lot of time and energy into a career or a job. It meant often living and working together in order to create conditions that were mutually helpful. Because when we're living and working together, when we're together all the time, we're less likely to forget what we're about, as it were. We're less likely to become distracted from the main thread in our lives, less likely to be distracted from what we're really aspiring to. And so we're more likely to keep up our practice of friendship, ethics, meditation, retreats, and so on. Also, when we're living a simple life in those terms, we have more time to give to others, especially if we don't have family responsibilities. We have more time for Kalyanamitrata, more time for sharing the Dharma. And living and working together, of course, one of the things it does is it contributes to creating a spiritual community. So it contributes to creating a spiritual community, which is beneficial for those who are actually living and working together, but also beneficial for those who, for whatever reason, can't or don't want to live and work together. So it creates something that's of benefit to everybody who wants to practice. So the purpose of living together, just to focus on living together for a moment, is to create the conditions where spiritual life can flourish. So living together is a practice. It's a practice of friendship, a practice of intensity of practice, of rejoicing, of appreciation, and all that. So it's a practice of interacting in a way, and interacting in ways that that support our spiritual practice. Also, of course, living together is one way that we can contribute to reducing our impact on the planet, which has always been part of Bhante's plan, as it were. Even back long before the FWBO was established, back, I think it was in 1962, when Rachel Carson published Silent Spring, Bhante organized for her to give a talk in London. He saw straight away the significance and importance of this issue of the environment and environmental degradation. So he's always seen that as also part of living a simple life, a bit like the Dhammapada issue about being like a bee that doesn't disturb or harm the flowers. Living together is also so that we can learn to be more flexible, learn to compromise, learn to cooperate, learn the subtleties of communication. The image or metaphor that's often used is being like pebbles in a drum that are spun round and round so that the rough edges are smoothed, so they become more beautiful in a way. So our interactions, as it were, through our interactions, we learn about ourselves, and we learn about our own habits and foibles and so on, and gradually we're beautified. We become more beautiful, smoother. It's an opportunity to be open, honest, confiding, to open our hearts with each other. And of course, it's also an example of a particular way of living. It's an example of an alternative, and it's an alternative both to the normal, as it were, nuclear family and to the monastery. So we're neither lay nor monastic, and our communities are neither lay nor monastic. That's we talk about them sometimes as semi-monastic, but basically they're a particular way of living that's been developed within Tri Ratna. So they're Tri Ratna residential communities, and they have various shades of intensity, as it were, but they're neither lay nor monastic. So it's an example of a way of living. Turning to right livelihood, the term that's being translated as right livelihood is Samyak Ajiva. And ajiva is also translated as mode of living. So it's not just livelihood in the way we normally think of it. It's a mode of living, which you could probably gloss that as lifestyle. Samyak ajiva is like right lifestyle. So it's not just about how we earn money or how we get sufficient to support ourselves. It can also be about how we spend the money we earn, about our lifestyle, our whole mode of living. In Vision and Transformation, Bhante talks about it as being embodying the principle of social transformation. I'll just quote the relevant bit. He says, perfect livelihood, this stage of the path, stands for the transformation of our whole collective existence, our whole social life, our whole communal life, and not just for the economic aspect alone. In other words, it stands for the creation of an ideal society, a society in which it is easier for us to follow the path, a society in which, when we do follow the path, we are not constantly having to go against everything that surrounds us. So he broadens out the definition of right livelihood to become like social transformation, or, as I say, Samyakka Jiva being right lifestyle or right mode of living. There's another in the Karaniya Metta Sutta, which living with kindness is based on. There's another term, the salahuka vutti. Vutti means livelihood. V-U-T-T-I, vutti, means livelihood. And lahuka, I think it's pronounced lahuka, is a livelihood which is very light. It doesn't make a big impact. So it's a livelihood, Bhante talks about as I think as a light livelihood or a trifling or lightweight livelihood. And he says it suggests a basic simplicity in one's attitude to life, a determination not to be weighed down by a multiplicity of wants and desires or onerous material commitments. So again, it's not just about how we earn a living, it's much broader than that. There's another term used in the Karaniya Metta Sutta, subaro, which means being easy to support, which again, being easy to support is about this thing of not making a big impact on the world through your activities, through your economic activity, or through any of your as it were, lifestyle activities. That's, in a way, the subaro, this thing of having a light impact on the world, is where the notion of give what you can, take what you need comes from. So in right livelihood, I guess a central thing is the ethics, so that the livelihood doesn't harm others or ourselves, that it's actually life-enhancing. But also, generosity is a key principle, very central, because a right livelihood or a right mode of living involves taking less for oneself or having... by taking less for oneself, you have less of an impact also. So that means that there's more of a surplus for supporting the Dharma or supporting teachers or whatever. And right livelihood also, of course, is another way of creating the Sangha. By working together, we're creating the Sangha. In fact, I'd say in my experience, working together is even more intense than living together. Because when you're working together, you really depend on each other in a way that you don't when you're just living together. You depend on each other for reliability or even things like punctuality and cooperation. So you really depend on each other when you're working together. So it's quite an intense interaction and communication. Then, of course, there's work as practice. Using the work itself as practice is part of right livelihood. which we probably all know about, using the work as a mindfulness practice, taking up personal precepts, giving a kind of full expression to our metta, and also using the work as something to reflect on, reflecting on our interactions, our communication, our reactions. Yeah. So the aims of living and working together are to create ideal conditions for the Dharma life, ideal conditions for effectively going for refuge, training in effectively going for refuge. And the aim is the complete transformation of the individual and of society. So it's a big aim, a big ideal aim, the transformation of the individual and of society. Transforming the individual through all those practices of generosity, meditation, communication, and so on. And transforming society through friendship, generosity, possibly most importantly, by creating a spiritual community and being exemplars of an alternative lifestyle, an alternative mode of living, alternative ways of both working and living. So the simple life cuts down on demand. It cuts down on demand, cuts down on consumption, and therefore kind of works against the whole idea of consuming, which is the, you could say, is the presiding idea of the societies in which we live, is consumption. So as an economic model, a simple life is working against that whole idea of consumption and consuming more. And that means less time needed for earning, or if we are earning, more surplus for Dharma activity. And the simple life also helps us to overcome the neurotic craving to consume. So it's working on this whole business of the consumption, both externally in the sense that we're consuming less, and internally working on that neurotic desire to consume. And it frees up time, energy, money to allow more generosity. I'm going to finish off with a couple of quotes. One is from a new voice in the Buddhist tradition. It says simply, for members of the spiritual community, the primary contribution and responsibility to the world is to keep the spiritual community in existence. And the other quote is from an essay. This is an essay called The Simple Life in Crossing the Stream. And Crossing the Stream contains a whole series of essays which were written by Bhante between the years 1949 and 1952. So it's when Bhante was a very young Buddhist, between the ages of 24 and 27. He was writing these essays. And they're in his style he used when he was quite young, which is quite flowery style. But this essay is called The Simple Life. And it's interesting to realize when I'm reading it that it's written over 70 years ago. Yeah. He says, men and women, bewildered by the ever-increasing complexity of modern civilization, cry out for the simple life as a drowning man gasps for air. Visions of cool trees and quiet cottages arise before eyes almost blinded by the glare of neon lights and ears well-nigh deaf with the thunder of traffic and shriek of machinery. During brief interludes of silence, the sound of white surf as it sweeps hissing up the beach, or the song of a bird as it floats sweet and clear through the moonlight from the darkness of the trees. So I missed a little bit there, never mind. But the simple life is by no means one of ease and idleness. As the town dweller, with his sentimental idealization of life in the country is apt to suppose. Nor is it necessarily associated with lonely hermitages wreathed in mountain mist or gleaming coral beaches fringed with languorous palms. Although the relative freedom from external distractions and irritations which such places enjoy may make them more helpful for the leading of a simple life than others less fortunate. The simple life is also a strenuous one, being the product of a process of simplification, a reduction of life to its barest essentials, and a successful accomplishment of this process is, amidst the monstrous jungle growth of the complexities of modern living, a task calling for unremitting endeavor and inflexible resolve. So the vast, the monstrous jungle growth of the complexities of modern living 70 years ago is probably an even more monstrous jungle growth of complexities now. And perhaps therefore it calls for even more unremitting endeavor, as Bhante says. I've certainly been thinking this recently that I think we haven't really tackled the issue of our relationship with technology and its demands on us and its calls on our attention, which we find it increasingly difficult to ignore. So I think there is something about a need for an unremitting endeavor in achieving an even simpler life than the one we have.